Life has its ups and downs, and like many of us, I face moments with depression. Music has always helped me find my way through, and I believe it can do the same thing for you. I'm James Cox, and this is the When Words Fail Music Speaks Podcast, a podcast about the healing power of music.
Hey everybody, welcome back to When Words Fail Music Speaks, the podcast where we fight depression with the power of music. I'm your professional handicapped host, James Cox, and I have another interview today, which is so great because I love this man already, and we just met. his name is Corey Clinton. Did I get your last name right?
Yeah. I'll tell you a story about that after if you want. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, so my guess is Corey Clinton, and he's proof that music can do much more than entertain. It can heal, educate, and even change the direction of a life. Whether you know him as Dr. Noise or as a songwriter, producer, and composer, he spent decades creating music that inspires curiosity, creativity, and hope for audiences of every age. Corey, how are you doing today, brother?
I'm great. It's great to see you. we were talking about, James and I were talking about right before I walked in here, I just walked in from my third show of the day. I'm on the road. I'm in a hotel here. And he kindly let me use the restroom before we started going. By the way, about my name, I remember several years ago at Safeway, they always do this thing now where they're like, thank you. They look at your card and they go, thank you, Mr. Cullinan. And they said, is it Cullinan or Cullinan? And I said, to be honest, I have no idea. I've heard my family say it both ways, and I've never asked. Yeah,
that's something strange about family names is you never know the correct pronunciation, even though family members claim to have it right. You know, because I've seen longer names, and each member pronounces it differently. I'm like, okay, yeah. No one knows. You know,
yeah.
So three shows in one day. I don't know how you do it, man. You must be tired.
I have 15 shows in 5 days on the road this week.
But that's
I don't do that for adult music. I'm a kids musician also called Dr. Noise, and yeah. I'm actually in Wyoming right now,
okay.
Which is funny because I'll be in California for 2 weeks, the 2 weeks following this. I played three shows for kids and families, and it's a gas. It's super fun. So,
right.
But yes, it's tiring.
Yes, I would imagine because I would assume you would get enough sleep the night before, but then again, I mean, you're on the road constantly, so you're not used to your own schedule yet, right?
I've been getting about 7 hours on the road here. That's not so bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Could be worse.
You're in Wyoming, right? And you're going to California.
Yes, I'm in Wyoming. I'm in Casper, Wyoming tonight.
Casper, okay.
And then I'm teaching. I teach at Stanford University for 2 weeks every summer. I run their recording arts workshop program, and it's a really cool program. And so I teach from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. 5 days a week for 2 weeks, starting on Monday. And
right.
it's awesome. We have international students from all over. It's great. I love it.
Nice.
So I go from the young kids to, at Stanford, my students are everything from, you know, college students to college professors. So it's fun.
Right. So I'm 46, so I guess I would be under that bigger kid age, right?
You would not be the oldest student I have.
Really? Nice.
Really?
Nice. Yes.
Any year. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
No, we always have, that's one of the things I love about teaching the Stanford. We always have, you know, I remember this one piece. We had a undergrad from Harvard, a 69-year-old piano teacher from San Jose, a 15-year-old, a high school kid from Hong Kong, and a 20-something college professor from South Korea, and they all collaborated on a piece at the workshop, and it was really cool.
Right, yeah.
And I thought, where would this group of people ever get
every
together?
Hundred, yes.
Yeah, so that was
only
cool.
Only in my shop right here, so. So today, the other day ago, you know, I've been researching you really, really good. I found your YouTube, and a month ago, you uploaded recording when woodwinds and running a session.
Oh yeah.
We are recording, and that I'm addicted to that video. I haven't finished it. You know, I got about like for like 30 minutes go. You know, but I'm super enthralled in the way you record stuff. How you teach people how to record in a recording studio. And look at it used to do. I mean, it's nicer than what I could dream up, you know. But if you don't mind, I would love to ask you questions about your recording studio.
Yeah, of course. Okay. The video he's talking about is, I actually did that series of videos originally when I was a recording arts professor at University of Colorado Denver. But now, like those videos, that's one of the videos that's an assigned video for my Stanford course. And it was done in my recording studio.
Yeah.
And I made those videos during COVID. I was a professor at CU Denver and we couldn't go in. So I just started doing like different types of teaching stuff to try to, you know, make it less boring for the students.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's COVID, you know, you had to stay inside and I don't know what the hell I did for so many months. I don't know what I did, but I got through it. You know, we all got through it, you know?
Yeah.
So let's start here. When you started your musical career, you know, I'm assuming it was at a very early age that you got into music, just like everybody else, just like me, you know. When did you realize that you wanted to do more than just do music as a recording? And what was the thought behind getting a recording studio, you know?
Well, there's two components to that question, I think. Is one was, you know, how did I get in? Why did I decide to be a professional music and teacher in the first place? And the second is about the studio. you want me to take those in order? Or?
Sure. Oh, we can do whatever you want to do, man. Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, I mean, I've told this story before, but when I was a kid, I had sort of a idyllic Silicon Valley childhood. My dad was the mayor of Los Altos, which was it's the town that Steve Jobs grew up in. And my mom was, you know, PTA mom, and my brother was this computer genius. Even in high school, my brother was interviewed by, featured by Jane Pauley on the Today Show when he was like 15 years old as a computer entrepreneur. and a month after that, that interview, my brother started having seizures. And at first we thought he had epilepsy, and then it turned out he had a brain tumor. And over the course of 2 years, he lost function of his body and had surgery. My dad took him to all the best doctors, but it didn't work. And my brother died, and my father, who had always been the best dad in the world, this was very tough on my father and my mother, and my father started drinking a lot, and my father died by suicide less than a year after my brother died. This was both when I was in high school.
Yeah.
And you know what, the reason I was interested in your podcast when my you know, my PR lady sent it to me was the title of your podcast is literally my sort of life story. I was, you know, when music fails you, or when music when speaks, words, when yeah. words fail you, right?
yeah.
I mean, I'm saying it my own way, but when, you know, when you're, this was in the 80s, a teenage boy in the 80s, it's not like I'm going around, I want to go around talking to all the other teenage boys about my feelings. And at the time, nobody was saying, let's get that guy a therapist, right? It just wasn't that time. And so music became my therapy, and I started not just playing music, but writing music that sort of expressed, you know, I wrote a lot of songs at that time that were about what happened. It was about my brother dying, my dad dying, and how I wanted to live my life. And I really felt in many ways, music was my therapy, the therapy that saved me. and so I wanted to pay that back, both by just, I wanted to continue that therapy by doing music my whole life. Mm-hmm. But it's also why I'm a teacher, because music really sort of saved, I mean, it sounds really cheesy, but music sort of saved my soul. And I knew that there would be other people out here, out there who that could happen with too. And I every year I hear that. I hear about students we had at Stanford who it changed their life. And I was a high school music teacher years ago, and I have still followed all those students' lives. And I just know music is something that can really make a difference. And the way I learned that was, you know, my brother's version of music was computer programming, and he was a computer geek before it was hip to be a computer geek.
Right.
Maybe it's not even hip now, but it was even less hip then, right? And my brother was like, hell, I'm doing this. I love this. This is what I love to do, right? And even as he was dying, he was still hanging out with all his geeky friends, and they were programming computers, and he became, Steve Jobs befriended him, and he would spend time with him. And I just remember, yeah, I got to spend some time with Steve Jobs. All I knew was he was the Joe Montana of computers.
He was, man.
But what I saw with my brother is, you know, even when he was struggling and even when he was dying and whatever, he was already doing what he wanted to do in life. And that lesson is just, you know, I'm sort of almost tearing up just talking about that. That lesson has never left me. It's like, you know, you never know what's going to happen. Do what you want to do.
Yeah.
And if you're doing what you want to do, then when bad stuff happens, it still sucks. Don't get me wrong. But you think less about, oh, if I had known, I wish I had done this or that. I mean, it's pretty simple, but it's true.
Yeah.
So that's how I started doing music. Your second question was the studio. I remember it was just a year or two after I graduated. I was a music and poli-sci major at Stanford, and as an undergrad. And I remember drawing a studio on a napkin when we were visiting my future mother-in-law. And I had a little spare time on my hands. And it took me about 15 years, but we finally moved from California. We moved to Colorado. We built a house, and we built a larger than normal basement, taller than normal basement, because I knew I wanted soundproofing, and soundproofing basically entails double walls with space in between the walls. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but you basically need a little more space. And so when we built this house, we wired it for the different rooms of the studio, even though we had no money to finish the studio, and it wasn't until like 15 years later that we actually finished the studio. But now I've got a control room and a window through to the main tracking room, and a piano and choir room upstairs with 22-foot ceilings, hardwood. And we believe it or not, we had an indoor soccer field there. I was a big youth soccer player, and I used to coach. But now that our kids are both gone in college and grad school, we converted the indoor soccer field to a big retro room. People can go look on my website if they want, and they can see pictures of this. And the retro room is 50 feet long. It's for strings and horn sections and stuff. It has a disco ball. It has an 80s video game console. Wow. You know, those old tabletop ones with like Miss Pac-Man.
Yeah. Pac-Man.
And like 412 old games. It has a record player. It has a cassette player. It has a boombox, and it has, this is my favorite part, it has a VHS and TV, like those little combo things, and people recording there only have three choices. You could, there's three videos there. You can watch on VHS. You can watch Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, or Return of the Jedi. Those are the only three movies that you can watch there. But so it's fun because I've built my studio. You know, I've done a lot of recording in professional studios designed by engineers. Mine's more like a kooky studio designed by an artist, and people have fun recording there. It's just, you know, it has a different vibe than going to the power station.
Yeah. Well, I do love your setup because I've seen a lot of recording studios, and I'm like, holy hell, what am I looking at? You know, yours is very, I've been told less is more, and I fully agree. And what you're doing on in your studio is fantastic, because I don't like looking at a lot of stuff around me, you know. I like it to be simple and but and manageable, you know. So yeah, so I really love the way you have all your stuff. And I am looking at the room through the window right now on your YouTube channel, and I think
Oh,
that's great. Yeah. Well,
and that video you talked about, the recording a woodwind session, that was
yes.
actually recorded in my studio. All those were, because
Okay.
we couldn't go in because it was COVID. So I did them all in my studio.
Okay, so let's go back to when you said music saved your soul. I find that so very I'm very connected with you right now, cause Mike, not to put your story off, but I had a cousin that died through suicide also, and I had an uncle that died through suicide, you know. And that's very difficult for us to do, you know, and to feel, to understand, you know, and to ask yourself, you know, what could I do more, you know? Why us, you know? But was there a song or some kind of sound that made you realize after that, yeah, I'm gonna survive this. Yeah, this is what I need to do.
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny. I've always had very eclectic tastes,
Okay, yeah.
and that's reflected in my recording output, and even in the fact that I do avant-garde music. That sounds like college professor stuff. I
Yeah.
do pop music for adults, and I do kids music.
Yeah.
But I did an orchestral album for kids. But to answer your question, I can think of a few in particular, and it's a weird combination. One that's not weird, I still do, met him again for the second time last year. I loved a pop singer named Howard Jones, who was very, very positive. While everybody, he had "Things Can Only Get Better" and "Don't Try to Live Your Life in One Day." And I loved his music. It just made me happy. I thought it was beautifully constructed. And I got to meet him in the late 80s, and I got to meet him last year too. So I listen to that a lot. I listen to a lot of rock music. I also listen to a lot of classical music. I listen over and over again. I remember one piece. I listened to the overture, excuse me, the overture to the Tannhäuser, the Tannhäuser Overture by Richard Wagner, which is the opening orchestral piece of an opera. And it's just so heroic, and so it's instrumental, but I would just listen to that over and over again, and it would like pump me up, and I could hear the pathos and the sadness and the sorrow of life, but I could hear in the music, I could hear overcoming that. And so those are two examples. I mean, I listen to a million things, but those are just two examples of things I listened to a lot while I was going through while my brother and my dad died. And one of the lovely things is last year I got to tell Howard Jones in person, because I know people have told me this about my music before, and it's always amazing. I got to tell Howard Jones, "Hey man, I had this really, I don't know what kind of language I can use on this
Oh,
podcast, but
you can let it fly,
okay.
brother. Yeah.
I had this really shitty, year plus where my brother died and my dad died, and it was hard on me and my mom, and obviously it was hard on us, but obviously it was less hard on us than them. And so you're not really allowed to focus on yourself. And I really found a lot of solace in your music. I got a lot of inspiration from your music, and I wanted to tell you that you're one of the reasons that I not only survived as a positive person, but I went into music because I saw you and I was like, oh man, this is great. I mean, he had this one man band electronic show, and that's what I do in my kids' shows,
Oh, nice.
right? And
Okay. Yeah.
it's all based on what I saw when I was a teenager, and I was like, oh, that's cool. And so I got a chance to tell him how much his music and his philosophy had meant to me, and that was, it meant a lot to both of us, I think.
I got to look up Howard Jones. Your Howard Jones, because my Howard Jones is vastly different. My Howard Jones was a lead singer of Killswitch Engage. So I don't think our Howard Jones are one and the same. But you know, I gotta look up your Howard Jones, you know.
Well, and to your podcast point, you know, most of us have a Howard Jones. I have other musicians.
Oh,
I named one,
yeah.
but most of us have, and a lot of those people are in our formative years, in our teens and 20s, when that's just, you know, this is why I love teaching college because, and I loved teaching high school. I mean, I haven't taught high school for 20 years, but, you know, at that age, it's just so awesome. People who are still forming themselves and are so optimistic about the world and you know, want to go out and do good things. And that for most of us in music, that's what we're trying to do through our music
Yeah.
is stay young and positive and optimistic.
Right. Yeah. That I okay, so when you were grieving over your brother and your father, or I don't know how to say that right, so I'm sorry if that come out
No, that's fine.
but the music that you wrote, was that written for and about them? And if so, do you think that that music actually healed you, or did it simply give you pain somewhere to live?
I'm not sure they're music mutually exclusive. That's an interesting question. I mean, it didn't heal me in the sense that I'm still a little, you know, I'm still a little strange because all that stuff happened, right? So I don't think, I think you learn to habituate and live with those things. You know, nothing heals losing your father. I know I have my kids now and I can't imagine losing a child like my dad did, and I desperately don't want them to lose a parent like I did. so I think it did. It helped heal me. I mean, I'm not fully healed, but there are also people who have gone through even worse than I have. I mean, I wrote specific songs about it. I had an album called My Oyster I released in the mid 90s, and there's a song called In the Doorway that's pretty poignant. That's all about my dad dying. And there's a song called Bright in Your Ways that's about my brother. In the Doorway basically is about this weird experience I had where my father was, you know, he was depressed and he was drinking, and this was very different than what he'd been just 2 years before. He was, and the community didn't really know he was going through this. And somebody, I answered the door at our house. I was a teenager, and one of my best friend's mothers was there, and she looked really sad, and she said, something terrible has happened. And I thought to myself, oh, Dad's died. And she said, I won't use his name, but she said the kid down the street jumped off a building in college in San Diego and took his own life. And this was a kind of macho kid 2 years in my brother's thing, in my brother's grade. And I had this weird experience of feeling sad and trying to feel sad, but also feeling relieved that it wasn't my father. And then 2 weeks later, somebody knocked on the door, and I opened the door, and it was one of my father's best friends. And he just started crying, and I knew. I was like, oh, now my father's died. And he told me that my father had died. And so it's like I had a practice run of it was the weirdest thing. And so that song is about those two experiences, but even more importantly, it's about my jumbled feelings of love and sadness and disappointment and you know, anger and empathy and all of that that happens when your father decides, you know, he's not going to stick around anymore and you're still around. So.
Man, that's
And I know it wasn't about, I know he was in deep pain. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard. It's hard. He was the He was the greatest dad in the world. You can ask any kid in Los Altos. He coached every kid in town. He was the mayor of the town, and so it was like a Shakespearean, fall from grace or whatever you want to call it. I don't want to be too dramatic, but it was pretty dramatic.
Oh yeah, well I mean that's a very rough thing to go through. So once again, I'm so sorry about that. You know, because it's always not good when you lose or anybody you love. Because I've been there. You know.
Yeah, you as well. I'm sorry for you. But yeah. And that's one of the points. A lot of, you know, when I was a high school teacher, they asked me to give a assembly talk, and I gave one. I talked about my life, and I talked about, you know, some of the things that had happened. Yeah. And all of a sudden, I became the sort of de facto, what do you call it, counselor at the high school, even though I was totally unqualified. And kids would talk, they'd call me Mr. C. Mr. C, can you talk for a minute? Yeah. And that minute would always end up an hour, right?
Right.
And I learned, you know, there's all these kids who you think are, what, you think this is some rich kid whose dad is a, you know, executive at Apple, and that's all true. But then there's all this other stuff going, like so many people have their stuff. And a lot of people have things that are just constant sort of pain and trauma. And I at least had, hey, I had this great life. And then I had this just shitstorm of trauma happen where my brother and my dad and everything. But at least I had been taught what a wonderful life could be before that. And I've always felt grateful that my parents, you know, gave me that lesson before it all fell apart.
Yeah. So I think my next question is going to be a three-parter. So bear with
three
you.
Three-parter. Just like Star Wars.
There it's you go. Right, which one's the best one? I don't know. Who knows? You know, for me, it's episode four. But so you've written.
Really only episode four or episode five. Anyways, go ahead.
Yeah. Four and five is great. Six is not. You know, yeah, who cares about six?
Though? Six is great too, but four and five, they're
right. Yeah. So, but you've written for adults, children, and symphony, and stage productions, and educational projects. That's a lot. Okay. So, for you, is creativity different every time? Because I know there's some stuff in the symphony areas that you got to write specifically for, but for children you just got to write about for children, and for adults you just got to write about for adults. Symphony, yeah. I would imagine, is a lot more busier to write for. Am I correct?
Yes, but here's one of the funny things. So when I left college, I wanted to be, you know, big time, you know, orchestral composer or something. And
yeah.
I don't know, but nobody ever asked me to write anything. Oh. And what's funny, this is one of the things I always tell my students, like, keep your avenues open and you might be able to sort of meander your way back there. So the way I started getting commissioned for orchestral things and classical music things was by being Dr. Noise. And I got commissioned to do a 60-minute live orchestral show for kids, introducing them to the orchestra. We did that. It was a big success. We sort of toured it over California. And then we made an album with the City of Prague Philharmonic Orchestra, and we had these two amazing opera singers who are both multi-Grammy winners. Isabel Leonard was one, Nathan Gunn was another, and a great cast. And basically, I ended up doing orchestral music and operatic and musical theater music through being a children's musician. And now I'm actually working with Nathan again on a version of the Magic Flute. It's very early stages, but I get to weave. What I'm saying is they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. To answer your question about creativity, I think I've always loved diversity of art and experience and people and whatever. I loved diversity before it was a cool word. I loved diversity after it wasn't a cool word. I've just always wanted to do all this different stuff. And so, I've always loved hopping around and doing an avant-garde piece and then a kids piece and whatever. But kids, I'll tell you this, kids are the most creative audience in the world. So kids are the one audience that hasn't decided what they want to do already. Did I just cut out for a second there?
Nope. We're
Oh,
good.
okay.
We're good.
Okay, it, the screen froze on me.
Yeah.
Kid, you just let me know if it does. The
Okay.
kids, adults are like, oh, I'm a country person, or I'm a rap person, or I'm a classical person. Kids are like, hey, you got music? So, I played shows today. I played a country song. I played a rap song. I played a song with the orchestra where I sang over the, like, kids don't care. They're the most creative audience in the world, as long as it's interesting and colorful and fun. So that's one of the things I like doing kids music for. But I would not be satisfied if I just did kids music, because I also like doing things with everything from, F-bombs to topics
Right.
that are not appropriate for children.
And non-suitable, right? Yeah. Yeah.
I have a sarcastic and angry side that I like to express as well. Yes.
I think we all do,
Yeah.
but kids just say whatever they want, and I love them for it, They don't hold back,
Yeah.
They're ruthlessly honest, and that's what I like
Yeah.
about children, not so much
Well, they
adults.
are. I'll give an example in the show I just gave last hour or whenever it was. I played a Beatles song, and I said, this is a song by the Beatles, and this girl in the front row says, I hate the Beatles. And I just started cracking up, and I said, well, we'll see. And then I started playing She Loves You, and by the end, she's one of the loudest ones going, yeah, in the chorus. And at the end, I turned back to her, I said, you still hate the Beatles? Because you seem to like
And
that.
she's like, nope, I don't. I love them
Yeah.
now.
Yeah.
So when okay, this question goes off for the last question. And this is building a song, right? So do melodies, lyrics, or emotions, which one lives in your mind first? To get the creative juices flowing, for
Yes,
you.
I am not one of those people who has an exact procedure. So the one thing I do, which I think is unusual now with everybody else, including me, we all have our technology. I generally write songs in my head and I arrange them all. I generally don't get to the studio portion of recording a song until it's all done and I know what the bass line is and I know what the string part is and I know whatever. And I think that's a little different than how most people operate now. But so I do experimentation in the studio, but mostly the studio is like, the finishing pad for me, where I'll be wandering around for half a year in my head, in the shower, in line at Costco, whatever, messing around on songs that I've been working on. And then when I know it's done, I know it's done. And then I do it. Sometimes it's sometimes it's a concept. I'm doing a piece actually. I think I'm gonna do it with my Stanford students. I'm doing a piece called Empathy that is really just based on a concept. And I'm gonna record that next week. Sometimes it's a lyric. I have a single that I'm gonna release on my birthday that's definitely for adults, definitely not for kids, on October 30th this year. And I won't reveal what it's called yet, but it's called something pretty funny. And the first thing about it was just the concept and the title, right? And then after that, the music came from there. And other things, it'll be like, I remember I was sitting in the hot tub with my daughter Sydney a few months ago, and I wrote this song called Dawn Again that I love, that I'm going to record in a few years. And we got out of the hot tub, and I went down to I said, Sydney, I think I just wrote a song. And we went and sat at the piano. And I just played it, and I was like, yeah, that's it, that's good, right? And she said, yeah, I love that. And and in that case, it was the music that came first, and I knew the lyrics when it's done again. But all the other ones were just blah 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 blah. Yeah, I don't know what the words are yet. And I know, like, we were talking about Beatles. There's this famous story that Yesterday by the Beatles, when Paul McCartney first wrote it, It was scrambled eggs. And he knew those, he knew that
Really?
wasn't the lyrics.
No,
He knew
like,
that
yeah.
wasn't the lyrics, but he was working on the music first.
The
He
melody,
knew the kind of
yeah.
song. He knew the lyrics were going to be something poignant. He just didn't know what they were yet.
Right, scrambled eggs.
So,
Yeah.
and obviously Paul McCartney's had a little more success than I
Oh,
have.
yeah.
But
Yeah.
I am the same way where I don't have a process, and I kind of like not having a process. Sometimes it's a lyric, sometimes it's music, sometimes it's a concept, and then I try to fit the music and lyrics to that concept.
Right. So
But
quickly,
it's always in my head first.
okay, perfect. That's where the majority of it lies, I think, you know. Some people get inspiration from other things, but with you, it's in your head first, which I love, you know, because it's from your own mind, you know.
Well, but I do get inspired. I mean, everything is derivative. I mean,
Right.
whether it's musically derivative or ideologically or idea derivative, it's not like I'm sitting around without receiving stimulus from all around the world that creates, we talked about In the Doorway and Bright in Your Ways, two songs that I wrote about very emotional things that happened in my life when my father and my brother died, right? So even when they're not. Even when they're not serious like that, they're usually. Actually, I went to Ed Sheeran concert in Denver a few weeks ago, and he said, yeah, my wife and my daughter and our friend and I, and he said something hilarious, which I thought, oh yeah, that's right. He said, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, here's a song. He was making fun of how many love songs he writes, and he said, I never write a song on a normal day. I write them on either a really shitty day where something really horrible has happened, or like the best day of my life where I met the most beautiful girl in the world and I think I'm going to marry her, right? That's when I write my songs. And even though that was funny, the larger point inherent in that is his songs come from his life experience. And it generally doesn't come from sitting around eating a burger, nothing wrong with a burger. It comes from something interesting intellectually or emotionally that happens to you, often traumatizing that happens to you, but not always.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but 2030 is only 4 years away, correct?
Say it again.
2030 is only 4 years away, correct?
Let me see.
Yeah,
Yeah, 2026. Yep, yep.
So in 2030 you have something big coming out.
Oh.
You have a book coming out with
Oh,
three
yay. Well.
albums. The book is called Scenes from Motherhood, Photo
Yeah.
Albums, and Skeleton Closets.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, wow. You're the first person who's asked me about that. I know it's on my
Nice.
website, but I mean,
Yeah.
yeah, I'm doing believe I mean, this is a crazy project and I've already started on it. The reason why it's coming out 4 years from now or whatever that
Right.
is that there's a lot going into it, and I decided I wanted to. My mother just died a few years ago, and I'm at that stage of life. I've been thinking a lot about, my parents and my childhood. My children are now 21 and 23, and heading off into the world on their own. So I'm thinking of all this life cycle stuff, and I'm doing an album called Scenes from Fatherhood. I'm doing an album called Photos Albums and Skeleton Closets, and those are sort of the light side and the dark side of family life. I'm doing a book that is about my experience. Part of it is about the experience I told you about as a kid, but the other part is about being a father of my own and being sort of a father figure in some ways as Dr. Noyes and as a
Right.
teacher.
Yeah.
And all the things I've learned through that, and the experiences I've had and things that I might be able to pass on to other people, or it would at least resonate, and they wouldn't feel alone, like they're the only ones who's gone through those things. And then also, I'm releasing, recording the times in that time, which will be. I actually recorded an album when I was 17 and 18 years old. My friend Mark Van Horn and I created an analog recording studio in the janitor's closet of the apartment complex his dad was the manager of. And we recorded albums in high school. And I remember I sent that album in. That was part of my Stanford application.
Right.
And I never released it. And it's kind of silly to really, it's cool, but it's a young kid's thing. but I'm going to release it in conjunction with the book because there are literally songs on that album about a 17-year-old kid's experience with his father and his brother dying. And I went back and listened back to it, and it's actually it's pretty hard hitting for somebody that age. Right. So so I'll release that. It'll be less, that release will be less like it's more like a nostalgic release than a, hey, I expect a million people to buy this thing. But it goes with the book, and it's actually very sort of interesting to listen to reading the book. But yeah, so I'm that's a huge project. It's three albums and a book that I'm spending 4 years on, but I'm releasing several other albums before that. Okay. It's a long-term project, and I'm a little nervous about it because it's funny. I want to help. I know people can relate to it. I also want to, like, I really love and respect and I appreciate my parents, even though obviously everything didn't go as planned.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a challenge writing it. So I'm honest, but loving. I don't know how to put it. I haven't quite figured out, but I'm working on it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying, yeah. But it's so great to hear that you're releasing new albums, because your album under your own name, Corey Cullinan, came out in 2019 called Soundtracks. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. I love the song "The Bad News." I think that's the greatest song ever.
Yeah,
that's great. So it's also great that you're coming out with new stuff, you know.
Well, thank you for listening to that. The Bad News is the first track on that album, and it was actually in a movie called Spy Game starring Brad Pitt and Robert Redford, and it was in a couple other things, and I was actually asked to write and record that for a film placement, which is sort of weird, but it was cool. And I'm releasing an album next year called The Bad News. This is my plan anyways. And it's a big band album. It's going to have that song and nine other songs, but that song's going to be in a big band version, which I always wanted it to be.
Right.
And I'm really excited about that. And it's a much lighter, or at least it's a less personal album than the Scenes from Fatherhood sort of series. And I'm doing that on purpose because I'm not sure I'm emotionally ready to release all the really, really personal stuff yet. But I'm working up to it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I'm really excited. So that song you like is actually the title song of an album coming out next year. But the version of the song in the album next year will be a full big band, not just a jazz quartet.
Okay. Yeah. And I guess the way that you're ready for the big band is similar to the symphony, where you got all these instruments to work with together, correct?
Yeah, I love writing for large ensembles.
And okay,
I took orchestration. I was a music major at Stanford. I took orchestration there, but really, you mostly learn stuff by doing it. But I did at least get the training, so I wasn't a complete moron starting. But mostly, it's doing, and it's just seeing what works and hearing it in your head and then hearing it in real life and seeing if it works in real life like it worked in your head. And but yeah, I'm really excited about the big band. That's one of the reasons we built the retro room, by the way, in the studio, because I wanted to have a room large enough, not just the piano room, to record horns and strings, but I also wanted it to look like sort of like cheesy retro, like that. That's the vibe I'm going for the big band album.
Cheesy retro, I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, is there or has there been a song where it's been just too, the emotion was too unsettling, too big for you to write and get out of your head or whatever, because you're thinking that the world isn't ready to hear what I have to say to them yet? Has it ever happened to you before?
That's a really interesting question. James, I've done a lot of, I've never been asked that question. That's a really cool question. I can think of a couple.
Okay.
But actually, no. Here's the crazy thing about me. I always end up releasing them.
Okay.
Yeah. But a couple come to mind. On My Oyster, there's a song called Little Rock Don't Break, and it's about the Little Rock Nine, who were 12 black students in Arkansas in the 60s who basically were not allowed to go to high school due to racism. There was this, it's a huge story. Right. It's a famous moment in history. And I did a song about that, and that song included all sorts of scenes and language and stuff that I'm not comfortable with, but I felt like it had to be in there to express what actually happened in this moment in history, and in an attempt to hopefully not have us recreate that moment of racism in history.
Right.
And I released that, and believe it or not, I actually got a letter from two Arkansas, famous Arkansas men who are on very different sides of the political spectrum. I got a letter from Bill Clinton, who was president at the time, and I got a letter from Mike Huckabee, who was the Republican governor of Arkansas at the time, and they both said that the song was really a really interesting depiction of Arkansas history. Yeah. And I recorded and released a live recording of my wedding proposal to my wife called Something for Janet. Nice. And then the other one I can think of is I'm releasing this avant-garde piece called Empathy, which is about something pretty traumatic that happened to me that has made me think about other things. And I'm actually, I've always been an open book. I'm actually not going to talk about exactly what empathy is about here or even when I released it. And it's the first time, like usually I'm like, this song's about my dad who died. This, and the reason why is I want it to kind of be a, I felt these really strong emotions and this trauma. And I know other people have felt that way. And I thought it would be interesting to release a piece, an avant-garde piece, where people could get what I'm saying, but not really know what I'm talking about and bring their own experience into it and not have mine cluttering theirs up. So I'm going to release that. And I have no idea if it's going to, you know, be successful and really work for people, or it's people are going to think, what the hell is this? It's
right.
Either way,
right,
I don't
do well.
Right. Yeah. And I don't really, I mean, I do care, but I don't care. And then, I have something very satirical, actually two songs that are very satirical and dark coming out next year, but I'm going to wait until they come out to talk about those.
And I think, and I don't think that a lot of people know, but isn't Mike Huckabee like a bassist?
No, Mike Huckabee is a really, really conservative politician.
Yeah, but I think he's a bassist. It's from what my dad told me or something.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I know Bill Clinton's a sax player, right?
Bill
he went on Arsenio.
Yeah.
So actually, is interesting.
Yeah,
that's one of the reasons. Yeah, they're
I'm
musicians.
I'm like 95% sure he plays bass. Yeah, because I think he was a musician and then he turned into politics, which, you know, we can all, you know, agree that politics is not, I mean, you know, the nicer.
Yeah, I remember, I can't remember which politicians, but there was this beautiful story in, I think, the 90s or 2000s. There were these politicians on different sides of the aisles in the Senate or something who actually wrote songs and did music together. And it was, I mean, you know, music is something that can really, really unify us.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
And then I guess, you know, I'll give you one other example. It's not really my story, but the single I released last week, I can't remember. It's a Dr. Noise single. It's me as a kids musician, but it features the experience of my wife Janet, who I've been with since 1989, and she's blind. And the song is called "Some People See, But I Don't." And we've been together since college, and she's the lead singer, and we've talked about it for years, but we and she have never said, okay, let's do this. Let's express her experience as a blind person. And this year she was like, let's do it. And so we just released that. And it's this sort of joyous, sort of funky, old school song.
Yeah.
And I think everybody will understand why I love this woman so much when they hear it. And, you know, when she first said, let's do a song about, you know, some people see, but I don't. I went down the studio. I wrote this very serious sort of anthem rock type of thing where she could really do this epic thing. And I brought her down the studio. I played it for her. And she's like, what the hell is that? That is not what I want.
Right.
That is not my story. I want some like scritty politty plus jazz, like fun little pop confection. And I want to just tell people my experiences. So she made the song much more fun than the sort of serious tone that I was going to take. And but I think it took her years. I mean, you'd have to ask her, but
yeah.
We discussed things like this. I think it took her years to get to the point where she was comfortable, you know, releasing that.
Right. Yeah.
And it's been very successful.
And some people see, but I don't came out July 10th. So that came out like last week. You're right.
For Disability Awareness Month, I think that's what it's called. I can't remember the exact, I might've gotten that right. I might've gotten that wrong, but, and we've gotten all sorts of reviews and it has, you know, a bunch of views now, and I've gotten a lot of, basically I'm riding on the coattails of my wife. That's what I'm telling you. I'm riding on the coattails.
Right. Yeah. Which is always yes. Awesome to, you know.
Yes. So. Yes.
We do have a few minutes, but I would like to end this lovely talk with you through what I call lightning round.
All right.
Okay.
Lightning round.
Yeah. So I'll say this or this, and you can give me this, and you just tell me what you think about that or not. You know, it's.
I think it's bad.
It's all bad.
Right? Oh, you didn't ask the question, right? Okay.
Yeah, I didn't ask you to go. Coffee or tea?
Tea.
Tea. Vinyl or streaming?
Oh man, that's a hard. Vinyl. I mean,
vinyl has better sound quality, but streaming is everywhere you go. So,
here, this is what I was gonna say. Sorry, I know this is supposed to be rapid fire. I'll say vinyl, but I'm being a hypocrite because I listen to everything digitally just like everybody else.
Oh, I do. Yeah. Well, I mean, you can't go wrong with that question.
So I will hypocritically say vinyl. That's my answer. But I'm answer. Full of shit. I'm full. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Final answer. Okay. All right. Now, I think I know your answer to this one. Beatles or Beach Boys? Since we just talked about it, it has to be the Beatles.
Beatles, but that's like saying, do you want great or do you want great? Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Favorite instrument you've never mastered? Or do you have one?
Yeah, the guzheng. It's an Asian instrument. It's amazing.
Okay. Cool. Favorite chord?
Chord.
A chord, C chord.
I'm going to quote Spinal Tap. This is the saddest key. Minor. D minor. Yeah.
Well, I love it's you for that, dude. So, that's awesome. Yeah.
And then this the person interviewing thinks it's very, very profound what he's playing.
Like, oh.
And then they go, what's this song called? And he goes, Lick My Love Pump.
That's right. I gotta watch the Spinal Tap 2 movie. I heard that's great too. So
we went and saw it on opening night. We saw the version where Rob Reiner interviewed the cast live streamed, and of course that's pretty poignant now because he died like 2 months later.
Yeah.
Anyways, keep going.
Okay. All right. First concert.
Thompson Twins, middle school. Right. Warfield Theater, San Francisco.
Right. This just came to me. Have you ever fell asleep during a concert? Because this guy has.
Yeah, today I fell asleep during my own concert. I have this hit song, Banana, kids hit song, Banana. That was the number one song on kids radio. And sometimes just to amuse myself, right in the middle of Banana, I just fall asleep. And then the kids in the audience go, wake up.
Yeah.
And I say, I'm sorry, did I fall asleep? I've played that song so many times. Yeah. So I've only fallen asleep at my own concerts is what I'm telling you. I haven't fallen asleep at anybody else's.
I guess that's good. You know, you fall asleep at your own stuff because, you know, you do play it continuously, you know. So a few more here. Favorite movie soundtrack?
Amadeus.
Oh,
Well, I love them, but if you're, you know, that's a hodgepodge of Mozart and others. In terms of somebody else's, I love James Horner's soundtrack to Glory. Give me any John Williams Star Wars movie or Schindler's List or Raiders.
John
All
Williams
of
is great.
them. Oh, and I can't remember her name, the composer. The soundtrack for Pride and Prejudice, the Keira Knightley, Jane Austen movie, is absolutely gorgeous. So
Okay.
there's a couple.
Perfect. Perfect. Last one. Most underrated songwriter of all time.
This is a weird answer. I think it's McCartney because everybody's all
Really?
John Lennon, John Lennon, John Lennon. John Lennon's great, but he's almost treated like a second-class citizen in that band, and he's actually the most successful songwriter in the world. But aside from that, I mean, I look at it, you know, I think you're successful if you get your song out. So yeah, I know. That was my weirdest answer ever because he's literally the most successful, objectively speaking, in terms of sales, the most successful songwriter in the world. But a lot of people are like, "Oh, McCartney, he's not John Lennon." I think they're both amazing.
I agree. I agree with it. I just love anything Beatles. I mean, they can't do no wrong in my eyes, you know. Or such celebration. But
You or I are going to get hate mail for that answer,
oh,
with people saying
I know.
that is the dumbest answer in the world. I'm just saying they're not wrong, but there's an element of truth to what I said too. Okay.
Right? So for everybody listening, you can go to Corey Cullinan, Cullinan, Cullinan. I still don't know.
I don't know
You
either.
still don't
I don't know either.
know. .com, and you can find him there. And he is on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and LinkedIn if you want to get in contact with him. And give him some free stuff or something. I'm not sure what you want to give him, but look out for the book in 2030. We gotta wait 4 more years, which is kind of strange and kind of
Well,
like hurry up,
can I say one thing about that
Sure.
though? I release, you can subscribe to it. It's on Substack, but you can also subscribe to it from either CoreyCullinan.com or DrNoise.com. But I do a noise letter that I release every month, and there are a lot of regular readers of it, and it's about my music, but it's also very philosophical and talks about, you know, emotional things and cultural things and things like that. So, and really the reason why I decided to write Scenes from Fatherhood, it's not like there's this huge group of people clamoring for my work, but there are a lot of people who have asked me based on the noise letter, "Hey, will you put this into a book? Will you write? We would love for you to sort of put these thoughts into a book." And so I do write a newsletter that comes out every month that's on Substack, and you can get it on my websites. And so, I mean, if you want to get really sick of me, you can subscribe to that, and then you can read all the bullshit I have to say once a month. I mean, it doesn't get any worse than that. You know what I mean?
And then if you're real sick of them, you could unsubscribe and resubscribe again,
Yeah,
until
you
your
can.
heart's desire. So
You can subscribe your friends without their knowledge, and then they will get harassed by my noise.
that's a great idea. I never thought about that before. So you gave me a devilish idea, and I love you for that. So all right. So thank you so much for coming on to the show, brother. We really do love you and beg you to come back anytime you want to, okay?
Thank you very much. It's been absolutely delightful talking to you.
All right, thank you, sir. And with that said, everybody, thank you for listening to this episode. And always remember, when words fail, music speaks. Bye, guys.